Studio 360.
First up, the playwright Annie Baker. Her shows are funny and riveting and unlike pretty much any other night at the theater I've ever had. Two of her first three plays won Obie Awards, the big off-Broadway prize. Her play The Flick won the Pulitzer in 2014. And now, at age 36, she is a MacArthur genius. I spoke with Annie Baker in 2015, right after the premiere of her play John. About a decade had passed between the time that Annie studied writing at NYU and when she produced her first play, so I started our conversation by asking her what she was doing for that decade between graduating and her first play in 2008.
I had a lot of day jobs, which I'm really grateful for now.
Like?
I worked for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire.
Really?
Briefly, I worked for The Bachelor. There's like dozens more.
So maybe you'll go to hell.
Yeah. That was only a week of my life, but it was a dark week.
And you're grateful because it's material?
Yeah. Once you sort of find your career and a job you really like, then you do interact with the same group and demographic for years at a time. And I had so many jobs in so many different parts of New York City. Oh, I worked for the Parks Department briefly. I just met so many people from all over the city. From all different backgrounds.
That's excellent. Since so many writers who only know other writers end up writing about either literally or effectively other writers.
Yeah, I've never written a writer character, and I sort of dread the day when I do that, even though there's nothing wrong with that. Some of my favorite books are about writers.
Yeah. A year after it debuted in 2009, your play Circle Mirror Transformation, just to go on about the enormous and amazing successes you've had.
It's really embarrassing.
Which is about a community drama class, was the second most staged play in America.
Yeah, that was really surprising. And not only, I mean, it's no longer the second most.
Right.
That was sort of a brief.
But why?
Amazing. Well, that was the thing. That was a total shocker to me. And not only was it produced in the States a lot, but it's been produced around the world. And I found out there was a touring production in Uruguay. And that shocked me because it was actually the play. When I sat down to write it, I thought to myself, I'm going to write something totally for myself about exactly where I grew up and the people I knew. I was sort of writing about this community center in Amherst, Massachusetts, where I grew up. And one of the things I've discovered since the play kind of took off is that most towns in the world have sort of an eccentric lady who teaches a drama class in the basement of a community center.
Yeah.
Like, that's sort of like a worldwide phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah.
And I wasn't aware of that until.
And I suppose also because, I mean, you are now have this imprimatur of being, you know, cutting edge and hip. And yet it's accessible. And your work is actually accessible. It's not, whoa, I don't get this experimental thing.
No, I think of my work as very accessible, if not too accessible. Like I beat myself up in private for being overly accessible and conventional. And so then I'm always really surprised when people say stuff like cutting edge or divisive. Because
polarizing.
Yeah, polarizing. That's been thrown around a lot.
Yeah.
We'll talk about that. And I think of myself as a panderer.
All of your plays, I think, have small casts, and they all have, and this has been much talked about, these pauses and silences. As you started writing in that way, what do you feel those spaces do for you?
You know, it's now become a thing that I know I do because people have told me that I do it.
Your tick?
That's my thing, I guess.
Yeah.
But when I started writing plays, it wasn't an aesthetic project. It wasn't a thing I wanted to bring to the
Your
theater.
Your theory of it?
Yeah, it wasn't. I wasn't like, people are going to have to deal with silence. I was just writing the plays as I heard them in my head.
Yeah. Somebody told me that for a production of your play, The Aliens, in London a few years ago, they did it super fast. And it was unlike it actually is supposed to be. Did you see it?
I didn't see it, but, you know, in New York, it was 2.5 hours. And in London, I think it was like 55 minutes. And they said all the lines. So that was
really less than half as long.
Yeah, yeah. So that sort of proved to me that 2/3 of the play really was silence, but I wasn't even aware of that.
Yeah. The characters in The Flick the ushers and cleaners and projectionists in this movie theater really are desperate to make some kind of human connection but can't quite do it. Do you have this general feeling in the world that people are talking past each other or acting like actors without a script or something?
Yes. Yes, I do. I feel that way a lot, and I kind of assume most people feel that way. I'm not sure. I also just, I feel constantly distressed by the amount of small talk that we all have to do every day. It, like, kind of drives me crazy, and I'm really bad at it. And I think, actually, small talk is something that I'm exploring in my plays, the agonies of small talk.
Yes. I'd never seen any of your work before this summer, so I go to the Flick. Which is this play set in a movie theater with three people who work there, and it's not driven by its plot and the relationship of these three characters. I thought I might hate it.
Yeah, from reading all the descriptions,
I thought it might be arty in a bad way and boring and self-indulgent. I imagined all the ways that I might hate it. And then I came out enraptured and loving it, and then rushed to see this new play and loved it as well. There are, however, for all of your acclaim and awards and accessibility and all of the rest, there are people who don't get your work at all.
Yeah.
And this is why you are called polarizing. Have you drawn any conclusions about what kinds of people hate your work as opposed to those who love it?
No, it's sort of an ongoing investigation, because I do find, especially in early previews of my plays, that there are people who really hate it and are really vocal about it. During an early preview of my new play, John, I sat next to this German woman who, in a very intimidating accent, kept saying throughout the play, this is so depressing, this is so stupid, who wrote this? And then actually at one point she did say, like, a teenager must have written this. What stupid teenager wrote this play? And, I mean, it was interesting to me that she said depressing.
Yeah.
I think I sort of thought she'd be like, slow moving, too long, but that actually wasn't her beef. I think it was too sad.
Your play John takes place at this B&B in Gettysburg. It's overflowing with kitschy knickknacks and teddy bears and dolls and stuff. And it is run, the operator of the B&B is this character, Kitty. Creating her, I was thinking about how conscious you were of walking that razor's edge between making fun of her, because there's some humor at her expense and her very existence, and making her the wise, totally lovable character that she is as well. Was that the conscious, like, too much this way, too much that way?
Definitely. I mean, that character I wrote specifically for an actor, Georgia Engel, who's a really sort of delightful person and is one of the smartest people I know.
Yes, and people probably know her as Georgette from
the Mary Tyler Moore Show.
Who married Ted Baxter.
Yes.
She's amazing.
She's incredible.
In this play.
And she has one of the quickest, most brilliant minds I've ever encountered. And so actually writing the part, I wrote it sort of with the knowledge that Georgia would be completely transcendent and likable and obviously really, really smart. And I actually, something I really wanted to do was set up the expectation that the play was going to be about sort of two New Yorkers and the Daffy, Pennsylvania proprietor of the bed and breakfast, and then actually have her turn out to be a kind of telepathic mind reader, Neoplatonist witch.
Yeah.
And that was part of what made me want to write the play.
But yet... it's this spooky house, and it was a Civil War hospital, and there's these suggestions of supernatural stuff and all that. But you never – it's interesting that you went there because it's not like your previous work. But you also – it's interesting to me that you didn't go fully there. There's not suddenly ghosts and – no, spoiler alert, or lack of spoiler alert.
You ruined it, Kurt.
You don't go fully magical realist.
No. I really wanted to deal with the feelings of the uncanny – and feelings of dread and the supernatural, but sort of all in service of the spiritual development of the characters in the play and what that all meant metaphorically.
And for all of that talk, it sounds, oh, my God, this is going to be this incredible talky intellectual play. And there's some talk about God, I guess, but it's not. There's not big Kierkegaardian arias in this play.
No, I mean, what I wanted to write was people trying to talk about the divine or the numinous or whatever you want to call it, and the way they might fail at talking about it and try to talk about it. I do think I'm really interested in failure as a playwright. I think that's in failure to articulate something as opposed to like really nailing it. And I feel like especially when it comes to talking about the divine, we're always going to feel incredibly
half-assed.
Yeah, you just feel absurd when you try to talk about it. And so that's something I wanted to deal with in the play.
Annie Baker, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Annie Baker's newest play, The Antipodes, premiered earlier this year.